Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that's all about unity and scumbaggery, and we do need unity more now than ever. I've got some shocking, horrible, terrible, this is like some of the worst news in the truth community that has ever come out, ever. It's almost as bad as the NDAA, almost as bad as the fact that there's a New World Order who want to reduce the population by 90%, almost as bad as that. YouTube is now censoring all truther content. I will say that again. YouTube is now censoring all truther content. All right, let me qualify this. I just watched one of my videos today with Deke Jackson and Craig Powell, show we had on yesterday. And normally when you watch a truther video of any kind, it'll come up with related videos. Like, for example, you know, it'll come up if you're watching an episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, it'll come up with other episodes of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It'll come up with other videos that other truthers have made suggesting similar content, that kind of thing. And you know what I found today was the only suggestions available at all? Avril Lavigne. An Invisible Mercedes, the new movie about the Marvel Comics Avengers, Justin Bieber's birthday, no truther content of any kind was suggested. This is this is red alert status here as far as I'm concerned. This is nuts. This is out of control. As if that wasn't bad enough. They're also changing all of the YouTube channels from the, personalized or personable YouTube channel format where you can, you know, change the color of the writing, you can upload your own images, you can upload your own banners, you can have suggestions about yourself and web links and all of that kind of stuff. You can have prioritized videos of your uploads so that they're the first ones that people see. You know how much of that you got now? Nothing. There is nothing but a grey, dull, shockingly crappy YouTube feed that has, it's just awful. YouTube is dead. I am really, really upset about this because that is how I represent myself online. That is how most truthers get their information out. And now not only are there YouTube channels just basically being taken out. I mean, this is what's happening here. Unless you are a mindless, dumbass, slave, scum, citizen of the web, you will not be catered for. Okay? This is the reality now. Who's happy about this? I mean, who called for this? Who wanted this to happen? I doubt anybody in the YouTube community did. Google, being the scumbaggery CIA asset corporation-y thingy that they are, most notably is probably behind this because, hey, if you have a look at Ron Paul videos with like 1,000 likes, do you have any idea how many hits you need to get in order to get 1,000 people to actually take that extra step, not just watch the video and actually like it? Okay, 1,000 likes and it looks like it got 300 views. Okay, major censorship is going on. I have my subscribers. I've got 2,576 subscribers. Okay. According to YouTube, that dial has not changed in a week. And I get more than 10 subscribers a day signing up to subscribe to my YouTube videos. And it hasn't changed. There is some mad, deadly scumbaggery going on with this right now. And ladies and gentlemen, you had best be aware of it. I wasn't going to go so rash and say, go ahead and leave YouTube or whatever. I'm thinking about it. Now I am. That's for fracking sure. This is pissing me off to no end. I have no comprehension of what kind of dip Shiite Muslim would ever even conceive that this was a good idea. They're insane. I'm just really ticked off. So everybody, you really do need to join the YouTube channel, Mr. News, Guerrilla Media. That's mine. You need to go there, subscribe, add me as a contact. You also need to go to Facebook, or Facebook for those who are uninitiated, and search The Death of YouTube as We Know It. I'll repeat that several times. The Death of YouTube as We Know It. The Death of YouTube as We Know It. There's a Facebook group there. For everybody who understands that YouTube is going down the fracking gurgler and you don't want to sit back and do nothing and not have your voice heard anymore, you don't want to have your content censored, you don't want to have your counters on your videos wound back, you don't want to have 1,000 subscribers dumped from your channel in a day, as happened to Max Egan, you know, you don't want any of that kind of stuff. This is the Facebook page for you. Please join up, because my goodness, if we don't do something now, look, YouTube is our tube, okay? YouTube, that's me, my tube. They're not their tube, not fracking NSA tube, not London tube train. It's YouTube. Go! And look, what's the alternative to YouTube? There isn't one. Basically, nowhere has the amount of people, the amount of content, and the amount of awesomeness that YouTube has. And what they're doing now is just taking it out. Okay? They've realized that YouTube is being exploited by the truther community. This is my theory, of course. They've realized that YouTube is being exploited by the truther community, and that we are achieving phenomenal success. Okay? Have a look at Max Egan's channel in Australia. He's 80th. Most viewed of all time in Australia, okay? And that's from the YouTube rankings. Do you know what happens to those YouTube rankings once they make the switch to the new channels? They disappear. There will be no more rankings of any kind. There is only one reason I can think of that being the case, is because truthers are being too successful and the establishment is threatened by them. That's why they need to wound back all those counters, dump our subscribers, destroy our channels, and make sure that the only videos that are suggested based upon our content is slave scum mentality, mindless, moronic trash. That is what is going on here. And I'm sorry I've kept going on about this, but it is that important. The death of YouTube as we know it. The death of YouTube as we know it. Facebook group. You need to go in there and add yourself to that group if you want to do something about it. You know, I'm mad as hell, and I'm actually going to do something about it. I'm not just going to yell it out a window or anything like that. I'm actually going to do something. I don't know what yet, but by jingoes, there is very serious action that needs to be taken here. How dare they? How dare they? Really? Now, developments this morning, switching gears a little bit. I woke up this morning to find two packages outside my door. One of which, a package from Jade Tuckwell from 9/11 Truth in Wellington, sent me a 32-gigabyte Phase 3 USB stick. What a legend. Thank you, Jade, for that. And also my sponsors, lovely sponsors, Blue Shield, have sent me two of the new model Blue Shields. We have the S series, which can be hung around your neck like I've got on today. And that gives you about a 2-meter radius of protection. And a lot of people don't understand what the Blue Shields do. Look, have you ever sat down while doing gardening or something, and you're on the ground, and you kind of feel a little bit kind of calmer and more grounded, sort of thing? That's because you're connected directly with the natural resonating frequency of the earth. Okay, what this does is it broadcasts that exact same frequency within a 2-meter radius, and because it's the strongest frequency in a room, it's the only one that your body actually starts to interpret. Okay, everything else, the body just doesn't even recognize them anymore because they're not strong enough to get through. It's kind of like if you're wearing headphones and you've got the music turned way up and somebody's got a stereo in the next room, you can't hear that stereo in the next room because it's canceled out. That's what this does, okay? And I remember one time, it was a few years back, actually, when I first got my Blue Shield, I didn't notice a thing. you know, just plugged in, had it in my pocket, it's all good, you know, no difference whatsoever. And then I left the home one time without it, and I was like, oh, what is that? I suddenly felt kind of sick, you know, a bit tired and fatigued. It just kind of came on like a wave, and I didn't know what the heck was causing it, and I just thought for a second, wait a second. This is exactly what the guy from Blue Shield told me would happen. As soon as I'm outside of that protective zone from the plug-in one, they have like a 15-meter radius, so it does your whole house. As soon as I was out of that zone, that's when the EMF wave started to hit me, and I actually noticed the difference. So I ran back inside, grabbed my portable, and it disappeared. You know, that horrible, fatigued, disgusting sickness feeling just disappeared. It was great. And not only that, they have a new product as well. It's the Blue Shield P series, which is for your pets. It has a little what's it called? A little key ring on it, so you can attach it to their collars and stuff like that. They've been doing tests on cows even, and they found that the cows actually even produce more milk, like about 10% more milk. I thought that very interesting. And people have been having these things plugged into their house for a while. And one customer actually had a sick dog, and the dog wound up walking over to the Blue Shield and sitting underneath it, and he started to get better. And they were like, that's really weird. Why is the dog sitting underneath it? So they unplugged it and they put it in another room. And the dog got up and went into the other room and sat underneath it again. So the animals can tell the difference. I can tell the difference. And so can you. So if you want to get one of these, and I highly recommend them, you know, I wouldn't be trying to promote them if I didn't believe in them. You know, get yourself to AmericanFreedomRadio.com and click on the Blue Shield banner, because they're really, really awesome. And quite frankly, I don't like the whole idea of being cancerous and fatigued and what have you. And a few years ago when I started doing all of this, I didn't do half the amount of work that I'm able to do now, because I feel much, much better. I'm capable of thinking more clearly, and I'm not quite so fatigued. It's basically, I thank goodness for these little Blue Shield puppies, you know? They seem pretty insignificant, but boy, do they make a difference. And now I'm doing like 2 to 3 times the amount of work each day, because I've got that much more power and energy to do it. All right, well, anyway, thank you all for listening, that you're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest today, had him on not too long ago, in fact, but I enjoyed having him on so much that I felt it was absolutely necessary to have him on again, because he normally talks about science, okay, like the but we kind of got into morality and religion and thinking about things and what have you. So today, that's what we wanted to really kind of cover in graphic detail, as he does. His name's Troy McLaughlin from thesatindeathcult.com. Troy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Vinny. Thanks for having me back. I'm just mopping up here, but you sound so angry at the beginning there. I spilled my coffee all over this.
Oh, that's not good. Okay, well, continue to mop up there, and I'll continue to rage.
No, we're good to go.
Okay.
Yeah, we're good to go.
Well, for those who are unaware, just explain a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Okay, thanks, Vinny. I run a site called SatinDeathCult.com. It also comes out as a Kindle version ebook, and essentially it's a study of mythology as natural history and human history as occult ritual. And what I've done in the book is I've drawn a connection between mythology and an actual alternative history of the solar system, a radical cosmology that says that the planet Saturn was originally Earth's was Earth's original sun, and that is according to what mythology tells us. And that in times past, when the sun existed, it existed in the north celestial regions of our skies, and it was a time known as the Golden Age, which came to an end when Saturn was knocked out of that position. And the ensuing doomsday scenario so affected humanity in the corporate sense, the psyche of humanity, that indelible archetypes were burned into the minds of the human populace, and these archetypes have served as a form, as a tool for manipulation by various malevolent cults, occult groups. But most importantly, I believe those involved in international finance and the running of the world's financial system.
Now, let's talk about the technical details about how exactly could Saturn have been a sun at one point of Earth?
Okay, well, I mean, the first thing to look at there is actually look at Saturn as it is today. It exists as a small little pinprick of light out on the outer edges of the solar system as we see it today. We can't even, with the naked eye, see the rings of Saturn. And such. It wasn't until the invention of the telescope in the 1500s that these rings were actually picked up. Yet mythology lets us know that the ancients were fully aware that Saturn had rings. Now, Saturn as a planet exhibits more qualities of a star than it does a planet. It's totally at odds with the modern concept of how planets are formed. And why I say that is because Saturn actually emits more energy than it receives from the sun, which is, as I said, totally at odds with modern cosmology and planet formation. So it behaves more like a star.
Interesting side note. Did you know that the telescope was invented by 9 people on different ends of the Earth at the exact same time?
I didn't. No. No, I only have knowledge of, I wasn't aware of that. But it was very much, many centuries after Saturn was depicted as being chained or within rings, as we see in the various mythologies around the world, particularly Roman mythology. Mm-hmm. So, we'll get back into why it's after the break, yeah?
Indeedy doody, thank you very much. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen. Troy McLaughlin from the SaturnDeathCult.com is my guest, and we'll be getting deep into this subject right after the break here on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Finger.
I wanna jam it with you.
In the face of very evil scumbaggery filth that are attempting to control the world. That's what the show is all about. You're listening to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. In the Fukushima contaminated Pacific Ocean, where everybody has a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest is Troy McLaughlin from the SaturnDeathCult.com. Troy, welcome back, and please continue what you were saying before break.
Yeah, thanks, Vinny. We were basically discussing how an interpretation of mythology could place Saturn, the actual planet in the north celestial regions, basically where the pole star is today. And I was highlighting that Saturn as a planet exhibits qualities that are much more akin to the sun than they are to any other planet. It is a celestial body that emits more energy than it receives. Its poles are actually hotter than its equatorial regions. It has incredible amounts of X-ray, radio wave emissions and such. It basically has all the characteristics of what astronomers would call a failed sub-brown dwarf star. And as such, it makes it a contender for this position as a sun in Earth's celestial regions, northern regions in ancient times. Purely from the fact that this is the planet that is actually identified by the ancients. as having existed there. So how could this have been? And this is where a concept called the electric universe is brought into play. The idea that the universe is not made up of black holes and dark matter and such that, but in fact, plasma is the main form of matter out in the universe. Up to 96% of the universe is made up of plasma, and plasma is the greatest conductor of electricity in the universe. And so, therefore, the forces that govern the universe are not just mass, as in the size of objects floating in space, but also the forces of electricity, magnetic, electrical effects, electrostatic effects, and so on. And so the electric universe postulates the idea that the main force governing the way in which planets and celestial bodies relate to each other is, in fact, electricity, that gravity is, in fact, a electrostatic phenomena. Another reason why you can explain why flies can stick to ceilings in your home and not be pulled down to the earth. There's all kinds of evidence now starting to come through as to how important the Earth's magnetic electromagnetic field is to life on this planet, and this within this electric universe concept, there is a particular theory called Saturn theory, and Saturn theory says that the Earth was originally a planet within the orbit of a sub-brown dwarf star that later became the planet Saturn. And that this relationship between Earth and the sub-brown dwarf star existed way back into the past, before humans were seen on the planet, and that this this configuration of planets Saturn and Earth drifted into the influence of the sun that we see today in the sky. And that the electrical effects, the resulting electrical effects or static discharges that took place, resulted in the sub-brown dwarf star that became Saturn flaring, going into a sort of a mini supernova. And from Earth's perspective, this resulted in a giant flaring of light in its pole star region. Just at the point in time that Saturn and Earth started to be captured by the sun. Now, this is what in mythology is known as the birth of the Golden Age. And under the influence of the sun, as it as Saturn and Earth became more captured within the sun's influence, the sun basically broke this alignment apart, and that event is the doomsday that brought about the end of the Golden Age, when Saturn and Earth were severed in terms of their relationship with each other. But it is basically an electric universe idea, and it's a radical one. It basically means that Earth and Saturn are the interpolators into the current solar system. We're the aliens that have arrived here, and basically things changed. And change within recorded history. This is the important note here. This is not geologically ancient. This is historically ancient, as in events probably happened within the last 15,000 years and didn't settle down till probably as little as 2,500 years ago.
And people think that celestial events and everything like that happen very slowly, you know, taking billions and billions of years. Oh, yeah. But this suggests that they happen relatively quickly.
Yeah, what I think you're referring to is the common perception today of what's called uniformitarianism, which is the idea that you look around what you see around you today and you extrapolate back into history, back into time. What you see today, and thereby you come up with a picture that there's just slow, gradual change down through the millennia. What Saturn theory is postulating is that the ancients saw a very, very, and actually very frighteningly different sky to the one that we see today. And that essentially the challenge is, from Saturn theory, that you cannot simply look around and, at what you see today and extrapolate it back into the past as if nothing changes except for very gradual, imperceptible changes. That changes actually take place on cataclysmic scales that have left indelible scars on the psyche of the human race over time. And, of course, this is in the Saturn Death Cult book. I'm drawing the implication on of what I've described. I'm drawing the implication towards how religions have co-opted these psychological scars into their various control systems, into their various forms of ritual. This has unfortunately resulted down through recent history as they to be corrupted into form into the various control mechanisms that we see being exerted on society today, and it all basically links back to these archetypes, deep rooted fundamental things that we have in our subconscious that can be triggered by people who know how to trigger them. Of course, the greatest one that they trigger is our fear of doomsday, which was what I believe to have been a very natural interplanetary event at the end of what is called the Golden Age.
And a lot of people are saying that we're heading towards some description of doom. What do you make of that, the predictions and what have you for the year 2012, for example?
Well, for 2012, I'm pretty ambivalent. I think things will happen, but I'm of the opinion that most of the challenges, to put it mildly, that we face are human-driven at this time. What I contrast in the Saturn Death Cult is that the ancients faced extremely real interplanetary catastrophes, whereas down through the scars that we've received from that time on our collective psyche have led us into a situation where the catastrophes we now face today are almost entirely of the kind made by man. And I'm not referring to global warming and man-made global warming and things like that. I'm talking about just basically the financial catastrophe, economic catastrophe, and, of course, our old friend global war. These are the catastrophes we face. For people who come to an understanding of the universe based on electric universe principles, we find ourselves refreshingly free of the Hollywood type cataclysms, or the type of cataclysms that we propose happened in the past. You know, the return of a giant comet, a planet, or such, or an asteroid slamming into the Earth. Electric universe frees you from that because you would know the signs to look for such an event if we were threatened by another celestial body, and they just are not present at the moment in what we can see in outer space. So, you know, I feel good in terms of the planet, in terms of our position in the solar system. Things are relatively stable. My concern is how the archetypes that affect us all, that give us this sense of doomsday, have been manipulated to keep a certain elite in control of the resources of this planet purely for their own benefit.
Well, let's talk about the actual science then, because, you know, some people would think, Saturn being right above us on the North Pole, you were saying, how exactly can you make that conclusion? What evidence is there to suggest that?
Okay, this is, of course, the most preposterous part of the Saturn Death Cult theory or hypothesis that people sort of find the most difficulty in dealing with. I thought it would actually be people, you know, the usual thing, hey, you're nothing but a conspiracy theorist, all this talk about the financial system and so on. I thought that's where I'd get most of my questioning. But it seems that there is a general awakening that the financial control of this planet, it has in fact gone awry, and people are awakening to that. So the challenge is, yes, how do you sort of, when you're told that the entire solar system has been around for 5 billion years or more, and in the form that we see, with the planets evenly spaced out, and they all accreted from a circumstellar disk that surrounds stars and so on, how do you, convince people that it could be so radically different? And all I can say is that the evidence first starts from comparative mythology. We have a choice. We can look at mythology and basically say, what a bunch of, I don't know, high guys these people were. It makes no sense, mythology. It makes very, very little sense at all if you hold mythology up against the skies that we see today. And so mythology has sort of become almost synonymous with a fiction in the modern world. We talk about myths, urban myths and so on, and this is related to fiction. Yet, if we then take the other stance, which is maybe these guys are reporting something that they actually witnessed, you start to get your first clues. Now, the interesting thing about mythology is that it's shared throughout the world. Diverse cultures, whether it's Mesoamerica, right down here in the South Pacific, the Asian cultures, North American cultures, and of course European or what you would call Occidental, those cultures stemming out of the Middle East and so on. They all have points of agreement that are uniform through them. And one of the points of agreement is this focus on the pole star region of the skies. They all identify this area as where the creator God resided, and where the original sun was. For instance, in Egypt, they talk about the midnight sun, which has always been at odds, something that I noticed when I was even a university student studying Egyptology, was you've got a sun that shines at night. How does this happen? It's totally at odds with what we see today. You take a term from uniformitarianism and such, right? Yet Egypt we've been told that the Egyptians worship the sun. Yet they refer to it as a midnight sun. And the only position where a sun can shine at midnight, of course, is if it is at one of the celestial poles, south or north. And, of course, everything is oriented towards the North Pole as such. And throughout all these different mythologies, it is always the same god that turns up as having been the creative influence from the north. It's always the same characteristics associated with this god. And for convenience in the book, I refer to it as Saturn, which is one of the Latin names. Before Saturn, the Greeks called him Kronos. The Egyptians referred to Ra, Atum, Osiris, and Pa, Quetzalcoatl for the Americans and so on, Hong Ti for the Chinese.
So everybody's got a different language and a different name for the exact same thing. You know, some people call it the elite, some people call it the New World Order, some people call it scumbaggery. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. We're back, ladies and gentlemen, broadcasting live on the American Freedom Radio Network, also on delayed broadcast. And welcome all those listeners in the South Island tuning in to iFinity FM late in the evening. I'm sure that you all really enjoy this show for some reason, because Greg Selman, who runs iFinity FM, says he can barely walk around the town now without people telling him about the Vinnie Eastwood show randomly. I thought that was pretty interesting. And my very special guest today, very special indeed, is Troy McLaughlin. Welcome back. Now, you were talking about the sun being around at night, and people calling this in mythology a whole range of different names. Please continue.
Yeah, well, so essentially what we're establishing here is in mythology, there is a very different sun to the one that we see today being talked about. It's a sun that stays immobile up in the north celestial region, so where we put the pole star today. And in fact, most comparative mythologists understood that there is a total ambiguity between the sun that the ancients worshipped and the pole star, which, again, is totally at odds with the kind of sun that we see today. So what gives? Now, what becomes incumbent on people who postulate that this sun, this mythological sun, was in fact the planet Saturn, simply because that's what they named it, this celestial object, the various names that are equivalent to Saturn in various cultures identify this body as Saturn itself. And what's incumbent upon people is, how did it get there? How does it work? And what I have to first put up is the reasons why people would say it doesn't work, it couldn't have worked. And that is Newtonian mechanics. Anybody who is part of the establishment academic world of astronomy and so on, they will tell you that this is completely preposterous. Newtonian mechanics do not work in this situation. You can't have a configuration like this without it flying apart, like in days, if it even existed in the first place. These are the same people whose model requires the creation of dark matter, black holes, and such, things that cannot be seen, cannot be proven. You cannot send a probe out into space to collect a piece of dark matter or anything. Yet, this is what is required. 97% of the universe needs to be made up of this mysterious stuff in order for it not to fly apart, according to Newtonian mechanics. Yet, it is yet to be actually any of our spacecraft, anything has come into contact with this stuff, yet it makes up this enormous amount of matter according to the established model. The electric universe idea, however, says that stars are actually an electrical phenomena. They're literally like interconnected light bulbs that go off throughout the galaxy, and the lines that connect them is the plasma that stretches out between them, these various stars throughout space. Plasma exists. There's no debate about that. The big debate is that mainstream physics does not believe a charge can be separate charges can be maintained throughout space. So they decry this idea. Yet proof is building up that in fact charges do exist in space, and that plasma is in fact the conduit for these charges. So if we take that as our basic model for how Saturn could end up in the position that we're postulating up in the pole star region, we go to the idea of what is a sub-brown dwarf star, because this is what we're actually identifying Saturn as, a failed sub-brown dwarf star. And what we find is that, even recognized by modern physicists and so on, sub-brown dwarf stars probably outnumber the bright, shiny ones that we see in the sky by magnitudes more. We just can't see them. The reason being is that some of these things glow at temperatures no more than 750 degrees Celsius. They don't glow as a sun, but what they are is, in the electric universe model, they are an electric static phenomena, and as such, what we actually see is the plasma sheath, which is this giant bubble almost like a force field that exists outside, that encapsulates the solid part of the star at the center. Now, the sun actually has this, has its own one. All red giants have this. It's called the heliosphere, all right? And it's this protective bubble that keeps us safe from the intergalactic, interstellar winds and so on, all right? And it's generated as a result of the electrical properties of the sun. Now, sub-brown dwarfs have this as well. And according to certain physicists who study these types of stars, there is more than the possibility. In fact, it's pretty much a foregone conclusion that there is a habitable zone that exists between the plasma sheath bubble and the solid part of the star. There's a space between that where planets can orbit and actually life can exist. And when we go back further into history and mythology, particularly with the oral traditions of the indigenous peoples of, particularly the Australian Aborigine traditions, certain South American traditions, African traditions, we talk about a time known as the Purple Dawn of creation. And this time period says that mankind existed on a planet that was in a perpetual twilight, and that this twilight was uniform, no seasons, no changes in temperature. Seems like a pretty boring existence, but certainly no want for food or anything.
Does this have you heard of canopy theory?
Yes.
It
was the original
explain a little bit about that.
My understanding, canopy theory, was that the Earth was surrounded by a canopy of water, and that this was how people who want to explain the flood of Noah come to the idea that this canopy collapsed, causing the flood of the Bible. I don't subscribe to it. There's a lot of problems there, not most of which is that the biblical account says that the majority of the water actually came from underneath the earth, the caverns broke up and so on like that. So artesian water was the cause of the flood. But basically, the idea that there was a misty canopy that once encircled the earth is actually it's consistent with the idea of a planet inside the plasma sphere of a brown dwarf star, in that brown dwarf stars, you can imagine a misty water environment where this perpetual twilight existence for the planet, you would see the planet saturated by this misty water environment that sub-brown dwarf stars generate. And before people go crazy and say, well, what's he talking about, water? We have to understand that Saturn is saturated. The planet as we know it today is saturated in water. Its rings are made of water, and they've only just recently in the last month announced that they have found a massive toroid of water around Saturn that can't be seen except under special circumstances. So Saturn is very much associated with water, totally at odds with Jupiter, by the way, which, again, goes completely against modern concepts of planetary formation. Jupiter is very different. There's virtually no water in Jupiter. All the water seems to have collected on Saturn for some reason. So sub-brown dwarf stars, if Saturn was a sub-brown dwarf star, could have an environment within their plasma sheaf where there is a kind of a mist of water that would affect any rocky planets orbiting within that plasma sheath around the solid part of the object. Now, what we're proposing in our Saturn, if that was our original sun, is that the Earth and Saturn enjoyed what's called a polar configuration. If you can imagine a string of beads, with Saturn being a giant bead at the top of the string, and hung down below would be Mars at this time, and Earth following it below it. So you've got three beads in the string, with Earth at the bottom and Saturn at the top. And basically, you just you twist the string so that they rotate. They have a coaxial rotation together. This is what we're proposing was the environment for the Earth under Saturn at that at the time when Earth was part of the sub-brown dwarf star. This polar configuration, do we see evidence of it? Yes, we do. Funny enough, the comet Levy-Shoemaker a few years ago smashed into Jupiter, but before it did so, it broke up under stress Electric Universe proponents will tell you this was electrical stress as its electrical charge tried to equalize with Jupiter. It was too much for the comet. It broke up, and I think it was, from memory, 27 pieces. And they formed, believe it or not, what's called the famous string of pearls. They traveled through space in exactly this polar configuration idea before finally being smashing into Jupiter. This is unexplained by mainstream physics to this day. How did they maintain that particular polar configuration? So we've seen evidence that polar configurations do exist, but that essentially is what we, in Saturn theory, claim the origins of the Earth started under a sub-brown dwarf star before being captured by the Sun as we see it today.
And we'll have to get into more of this after the break. My very special guest is Troy McLaughlin from the SaturnDeathCult.com. Very interesting conversation to be had. We still have one more hour with them. And thank you very much, Troy, for giving us some of your valuable time today here. We'll be back right after the break, ladies and gentlemen. Tune in at the chat room in the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. Apparently, there's some problems with the streams. So if you are having problems, click on the Listen Live Flash Player link for American Freedom Radio. You can get that at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. Back in a minute. It is now hour number two. Ladies and gentlemen, you're tuning in, dropping down to the level of a sociopathic criminal scumbag. This is the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that's all about basically not really caring about the Earth and just wishing everybody would be exterminated already in a death camp after sufficient gun ban legislation has been passed to make them all defenseless. My very special guest is Troy McLaughlin from the SaturnDeathCult.com. Troy, welcome back. Now, what were we talking about just before we got off to the break there?
Well, essentially, we were talking about Earth under a sub-brown dwarf star, as in the origins of this planet being radically different from the idea that the planet evolved around the current sun. And I think probably at this stage, with most people, would be sort of reeling in terms of this kind of information. But look at it from this point of view. Sub-brown dwarf stars far outnumber the stars that we see and shine in the sky. They're everywhere. A lot of them are very close. And if we are correct in the Electric Universe model that this is the nature of sub-brown dwarf stars, this idea that they have a solid center, but they have this giant egg-like plasma sheath, and that within that, in the space between the solid center, the yolk, you could say, of the egg and such, there is this habitable area for planets. What we're actually proposing is that this is probably the best place to go looking for life outside of the solar system. And we're obviously proposing that life began on Earth under this environment. So what would life under a sub-brown dwarf star look like? What would it be like? Well, first of all, within Saturn theory, there is a certain amount of debate as to establish how Saturn or the sub-brown dwarf star could have existed at the north, where it would have remained sort of still rather than rotating around the Earth in the way from Earth's perspective, like we see the sun today. And basically, there's two ideas. One, that the Earth revolved around its parent sub-brown dwarf star in the way that the moon revolves around the Earth today, i.e. the same face of the planet is facing central star. This is called the phase lock orbiting idea. I favor the other idea, that they were actually in a coaxial arrangement where Earth was beneath south of Saturn and spun on the same axis as Saturn did during that time. Now, both are valid, except when it comes to the exciting moment when this proposed configuration comes into contact with the sun and the effects that would happen there. If you were under Saturn, irrespective of whether it was a phase lock or a polar configuration, what you would have is a world that was wrapped in an eternal twilight, and the sky would be just a dark, chaotic, purplish mass. This, the reason for the purple, the mention of purple there, is that the light spectrum that sub-brown dwarf stars emit would actually translate into a fairly purplish sort of looking environment to the human eye. Your world would be predominantly red vegetation, not green, under such a such an environment, and you would have no reference to the outside galaxy. You would have no reference to stars outside. The plasma sheath that encapsulates this entire planetary configuration would block out all incoming light. Now, if that plasma sheath were to touch another plasma sheath of a larger celestial body, such as a red giant, there would be catastrophic discharge effects. That plasma sheath would be neutralized, and suddenly, whoever lived within that environment that we've described would suddenly be confronted with the outside galaxy, all these stars. Basically, Saturn's plasma sheath would turn transparent. And as a result of that as well, there would be the ongoing electrical effects that would cause Saturn to flare. There would be a reaction, electrical reaction within the sub-brown dwarf that would cause it to flare up into a bright light and discharge a lot of material from its interior. And prior to this, of course, what we're saying is that Saturn had no rings. These rings that we see around Saturn today, we are postulating that the effect of Saturn meeting up with the sun in electrical terms, both the Saturn's plasma sheath brushing against the heliosheath of the sun, resulted in a discharge of material from Saturn as it novaed. And this, in mythology, is what many Saturn theory investigators identify as the let there be light moment in human history, the moment of creation. So what we're saying is that it's not really creation of all in the traditional Christian idea, you know, zap, 6 days, and the earth came from nothing into something. What we're postulating is that there's such a massive change in the environment takes place that things look so different for anybody who would have been on Earth at that time. It's as if a creation moment has happened. This body that had glowed dully in the north suddenly erupts into a bright light, saturates the Earth in this light, while at the same time you've got these other stars that seem to be suddenly materializing as if out of nowhere. And one particularly large star starts cropping up on what we call now the east, and starts to get larger and larger as this group of planets gets drawn into the sun's influence. This is such a moment in human history. What we're describing here, we call it the let there be light moment. It is the beginning of creation from that perspective. Does that make sense?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, from that point on, you have a glowing disk now in the north, but you have also an encroaching light coming out of the east. And this glowing disk up in the north starts to develop rings around it from where its circumstellar disk discharges material. We know that material, if it is Saturn, as we're saying it is, to be ice crystals that were dropped out of the that were discharged out of the planet and formed into these rings. There are 7 rings around Saturn that are visible at this time. This correlates to the 7 days of creation. Various other mythological connections there. But nonetheless, the Earth remains bathed in this beautiful golden light that Saturn now shines down from the north on, while at the same time there is a light starting to approach from the east. And what happens is that humanity has the biggest epiphany in its history to date, and that is that they are suddenly able to calculate time. And that is why the god Kronos, or the god Saturn, is associated with time. This is the most obvious effect on humanity, other than the physical effects, is that it now has a tool to be able to break day into night and calculate a measure that we call time. And, of course, from that, as a result of these events, humanity goes down the track of weights and measures, developing weights and measures, the fundamental building blocks for ultimately creating societies or civilization. So I'm saying that this moment actually was the precursor, the moment for the creation of civilization, not the creation of the Earth, but the creation of civilization on the planet, in that it gave people the tools to develop weights and measures, and ultimately the rule of law as a way of governing societies. And, of course, this in mythology is what's referred to as the Golden Age.
Now, shifting gears here a bit, we had a couple of questions on the chat room that I wanted to run by you. Somebody wanted to ask you about the symbology of the Saturn model and how it is used in modern society. Could you address that at all?
Yes, certainly. Saturn plays an incredibly important role in occult thinking and so on. There's a lot of numbering systems and so on based around Saturn, and particularly its cycle, its 29-year cycle and so on. There is so much linked in to Saturn in occult circles, but most of it is derived from the mythology, i.e. that Saturn is, in fact, the original creator god. But being the god of time, time eats everything. Time destroys everything as time goes by. And so Saturn is often linked into the holding of the scythe, the Grim Reaper, which, of course, also links into modern Christian conceptions of Satan and so on like that. This idea of death comes from Saturn. So there's two interpretations that are very big out there. Saturn as creator, father creator, but also Saturn as murderous devourer of his own children and Grim Reaper bringing destruction on the earth through his capricious nature and such. Does that answer along those lines?
I hope so. And the second question we have, I'll read the statement out, actually. I think the Saturn death cult model is key to understanding the symbology, just another way to cut through this supposed sigil magic.
Absolutely. The book was written really to be a tool to understand the origins of what these people are attempting to do. Basically, you have a psychopathic, and I do mean that in the clinical sense, a psychopathic group of people who have the ability to recognize these archetypes that infest our subconsciousness, our collective psyche as a species, and they've learned how to manipulate that. Sigil magic, various other occults, and so on, and the use of it, the alchemists. It all goes back to these original archetypes. How they use it is what determines whether they have a malevolent intention or whether they have a benevolent intention. There's a lot of people out there that alchemists who genuinely want to help humanity. There are people even involved in occult thinking who have an idea for a new golden age that isn't this idea that the species has to die in order to be reborn and move on. However, Saturn Death Cult was written basically to provide an explanation, a natural explanation for the origins of many of these archetypes that serve as the basis for these forms of these magic systems and sigil systems and things like that. Yeah, definitely.
And another question, is Saturn a symbol for the son of perdition? I'm not exactly sure what that means. And if so, why are people worshipping, discussing, and explaining that sun's theories?
Ah, right. I can only imagine, and I could be wrong here, that the son of perdition they're referring to is the biblical reference. The son of perdition that will be revealed. This is heavily based on Christian eschatology, the idea of the Antichrist, the beast, the son of perdition as this evil sort of counterpart to Jesus Christ. Okay. Yes. All I can say from that is that in mythology, the planet Saturn is associated with the cause for the beginning of the Golden Age, i.e. the Creator God. It takes the role of the Creator God because it basically shed light on the Earth at that time. Down through history, I believe that these symbols and ideas have been manipulated, corrupted, to feed the agendas of certain peoples down through time. And it is perfectly logical that for some, this creator being could be associated with Satan and the son of perdition, his human incarnate form, in accordance with Christian thinking. There is definitely an obsession. I agree with the question, what the question is implying. There is definitely an obsession that has been growing around Saturn. Why were the rockets that were sent to the moon called Saturns? Saturn Vs, Saturn Sixes, things like that. Look at NASA with its logo centered around, it's got rings around its logo in the way that Saturn has. There's a whole list of
of logos that are all Saturn. So it's the most common one that everybody should be familiar with is the Nissan car logo, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. It's Saturn is an obsession, particularly on what I would call the NASA military-industrial complex as it stands today, especially with the Nazi scientists that were brought there after the Second World War to work on the NASA programs, Operation Paperclip, linked in with Jet Propulsion Laboratory boys that were conducting all kinds of funny rituals while building rockets and things like that. There is this definite obsession with Saturn.
Was that obsession also shared by perhaps the Nazi regime, the Third Reich during World War II by chance?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Because guess who became the head of NASA? Wernher von Braun, who was the designer of the V2 mm-hmm. rocket for Nazi Germany. And then, as you said, the logo for NASA became a Saturn symbol.
Absolutely. The Nazis had as their main symbol the Black Sun. So what the swastika is largely derived is a corrupted form of what came down known as the Black Sun. Of course, the Black Sun is the midnight sun. We were talking about this earlier in the program. This sun that shone at night. So the Nazis had a definite connection. Whether those guys were clever enough to actually make the connection on anything more than esoteric levels, I don't know. What I'm doing is I'm making the connection on a natural history level. I'm going up against the idea of uniformitarian development of the solar system to propose why the symbolism exists. And how it's used by people, down through the ages.
Mm. More of coming up after the break, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to the soothing sounds of Troy McLaughlin from the SaturnDeathCult.com on American Freedom Radio. Back in a moment.
Wherever you roam, and admit that the waters
a vine you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
Welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the show that's all about change, because it's the only thing left in our pockets after the taxes of Barack H. Obama have taken all the rest of the real money. If, in fact, none of it ever existed anyway. This is all made up by the Federal Reserve. My very special guest is Troy McLaughlin from thesatandeathcult.com. Check it out. Very interesting. And also, we did an exclusive off-air webcam interview with Troy, so you can see that. And in fact, if you want to go to my YouTube channel today, probably be the day to do it if you are listening live, because it is the last chance you will ever have to see my YouTube channel not looking like dull, grey crap, because tomorrow, YouTube, that was a Freudian slip there, will be changing everybody's channel arbitrarily and despite everybody's complaints, and I cannot find a single person on the web that thinks that this channel switchover is a good idea. If you search Troy McLaughlin on my YouTube channel, Mr. News, Guerrilla Media, you can find the link on AmericanFreedomRadio.com under the show hosts, and you can also find that at the top of the page at TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com and GuerrillaMedia.co.nz. So check it out. It was quite an interesting interview there where we talked about the financial system. Now, back to some of the questions we've had from the chat rooms. And by the way, I just wanted to mention to you in the chat room that Troy's actually quite, you know, tickled pink by the fact that somebody's actually asking direct questions through the chat room for once. One of you said that I heard that the swastika was a Hindu symbol for peace and prosperity, and that some Christians say it is the cross bent by the devil.
Mm. yes and no, is the answer that I would give to that one. Yes, no, the swastika does derive from Hindu origins. The common understanding is that the Nazis reversed the direction of the bend to give it the opposite of peace that you would see. When I lived in Hong Kong and China, I was regularly confronted with swastikas on the gates of houses and so on. They're usually in a very upright rather than the slightly angled sort of vision that the Nazis had. But, yeah, it goes all the way back, and it's most associated with the Hindu gods Vishnu, Varuna, Kalakakri. There's also a Prajapati. Now, all of these gods are actually derivations of Saturn, or Saturn is a derivation of that. They're the Hindu version of Saturn, and it links definitely into the idea that the swastika has its origin as a Saturnian symbol, going way back. And again, I would emphasize, I don't know how clever the likes of your average Hitler, Goering, Goebbels were in, or even Himmler, in knowing what that actually meant. Certainly on an occult level, these guys looked at this symbol and took it for themselves. But I doubt very much they understood what I'm saying here about, you know, it being a natural event in the cosmology of the solar system rather than some kind of divine revelation. As far as the cross being bent, when it comes to Christianity and so on, I think that's, you know, that goes to the Christian idea that the world is black and white. It's good versus evil, God versus the devil, and such. And so they look for that. But I don't give that too much substance as a legitimate interpretation.
Mm-mm-mm. But if you are looking for bent cross symbols in terms of Satanism, you need look no further than the peace symbol.
Yes, that's right. The broken, or the witch's foot, the broken cross, which was the cross upside down. The way the Pope wears his cross, I don't know if anybody's ever noticed that he wears the cross upside down. He does so because it's believed that St. Peter, the founder of the Catholic Church, supposedly was crucified upside down, so that's why they have their cross that way. But nonetheless, yes, the witch's foot, the idea of turning it upside down, breaking the wings of the cross, then putting it inside a circle and stamping on it, has always been part of the whole occult lore based around the cross and so on. Once again, I think the cross really has its origins. If we're sort of looking back at Saturn symbols or Saturnian symbols that have come down, in describing this polar configuration, if you cast yourself back to what I'm telling you the Golden Age may have looked like, you're looking up into the north of the sky, you see a bright sun up there, a glowing disk. Beneath it are two other planets. By this time, Saturn had ejected the planet Venus, and Venus had settled in front of Saturn, so it was silhouetted against Saturn, but was glowing under its own particular strength, having just been ejected from that star. In front of that, or below that, is Mars, silhouetted against Venus. Now, when you look at that in a less electrically live environment, what you're actually looking at is a giant eyeball in the sky. It has that effect. When Venus flared electrically itself, it would shoot out various forms of star-like shapes, eight-pointed crosses, six-pointed crosses, sometimes a four-pointed cross. So the cross idea, or the particularly the eight-pointed cross, for instance, the Union Jack of the United Kingdom, this idea of an eight-pointed star really has its origins back in the planet Venus and its relationship to Saturn and Mars and in front of it. Once again, as I say, I'm just trying to give tools out there to see where the origins of these things come. There are people out there who believe in the cross and the religion aspect. I'm not impinging upon that. I'm not impinging on people with their Quranic beliefs and so on. I think it's completely legitimate that these symbols end up in some religions. It's just that in some cases, they are used for nefarious purposes, i.e. control of other people, or they are used for benevolent purposes. But hopefully Saturn Death Cult gives you the tools to identify at least where these things come from.
And as the French say, women are from Venus, men are fromage. What was it? There was another question in the chat room. Do Tibetans actually communicate with Saturnians via their deep meditation practices? I think that's a very odd question, but I don't know.
Okay. They attempt to communicate just as Christians, just as Muslims do, through prayer. It's their form of prayer. A lot of Tibetan stuff is linked into this idea of the mound, the mount of God. In Greek terminology, we call this Mount Olympus. And once again, yet again, we find a northern orientation for this. It's just like the Hindus, the most holy part of the Ganges River is the part of the river that flows towards the north. And it's the same with the Tibetans, with their with the way they circle their mountains, their holy mountain, and the prayer wheel and so on, which is very evocative of the rings of Saturn and so on along those lines. But what we have to understand is that the deep archetype here is that where Saturn existed under the scenario in the celestial north becomes the abode of God or the gods, depending on which culture you have. Now, whether or not you believe that particular celestial body is the god, Allah, like some of the interpretations from Greek and Roman mythology and Egyptian mythology, or you believe that that's where God will be found, i.e. the creative impulse on the earth, the thing that sustains the earth, emanates from that position. you know, it's really irrelevant to the concept that I'm putting forward here, in that they simply identify the northern part of the celestial realms, the pole star area, as where all that power originally came from. They don't identify it with the sun that rises in the east and sets in the west. It's always got this northern orientation, whether it's the pyramids, whether it's aspects of Stonehenge and the associated line that through the other henges going north. There's you will always find a northern orientation that is significant in these various monuments and so on. And so, therefore, when it comes to the Tibetans, you know, they have every right, of course, to attempt to get themselves into contact with their original creative force. You know, Christianity is exactly the same. So, yes, they probably do try to, through their meditation, set up the right frequencies. I think they're actually on to an interesting idea there, simply because sound frequencies are very analogous to electrical frequencies. And what I'm proposing in Saturn Death Cult is that there's actually electrical forces that determine how our cosmos actually works on a far larger scale than what, you know, than Newtonian mechanics does.
Now, Santos Bonacci has said that the cross symbolizes the quarters of the astrological circle. What do you make of that?
Well, there is a lot of, and this is probably where, in terms of cosmologically based ideas, I come into conflict. My particular take on the origins of the Earth and its involvement around Saturn means that the astrological placement of the constellations as they exist today is actually a very young idea. We really only have 3,000 to 4,000 years at most where we were able to identify and establish the positions of the zodiac, as it's known. And, of course, the zodiacal people who delve into the subject have made a connection with what's called celestial wobble, the precession you know, of the equinox, and not the precession of the equinox. The help me out here, Vinny. It's the way in which the circle that is in the celestial north, we wobble slightly in relation to that, and that wobbling relationship is, I think, from memory, and I could be wrong, it's a 26,000 year cycle as it stands at this time. And for some people, this points to immense antiquity for certain esoteric traditions, i.e., you know, they've known about this for over 26,000 years and such, okay? So I come into problems with people who base the, base interpreting man's past on astronomical observations that should have always been there for at least 26,000 years, 40,000 years, and so on. It goes back to my whole problem with the idea of a uniformitarian interpretation of the solar system. What is, you know, connected there? It does, irrespectively, it has played a tremendously important role since its establishment. I'm just simply saying that its establishment is a lot younger than a lot of people would believe, and that would, you know, a lot of people would be very, would have very contentious views on that, you know, against my own theory, which I'm perfectly willing to accept.
Now, there's also the other elements as well, because we are talking about a cult literally worshipping Saturn. What are their plans for the planet? I mean, we talked about Saturn being perhaps the death bringer, the Grim Reaper, and what have you. Is that essentially a large part of what these people see as their role on this Earth, is to fulfill the promise of Saturn by exterminating the masses of humanity?
Yeah, it's not quite as simple as that. It's the old story, you know, the true fanatics and dangerous people of the world are the ones who think they're doing the most good. there's a this idea that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and what's at the basis of this is this idea that Saturn heralded in the original golden age when everything was lovely. The golden age finished as a result of a great cataclysm, a doomsday of which Saturn lost its place in the celestial realms. It was replaced by Jupiter, Zeus, this sort of stuff. And you come down through the ages and people yearn for the time that was before this doomsday epoch. And the symmetry that is created in many occult belief systems is that we need another doomsday day to trigger a new golden age, all right? I.e., this doomsday is really a rebirth of the human species in the next evolutionary step, so to speak, for the human species.
Well, the Chinese character for crisis is the exact same character as that for opportunity. So bear in mind, ladies and gentlemen, that it's just like it says in Fight Club, it's only after you've lost everything that you're really free to do anything. My very special guest is Troy McLaughlin from thesaturndeathcult.com. And we'll be right back just after the break. You can join us in the chat room at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. Back in a minute.
One thing I need to know, whose side are you on?
We're talking about the Saturn Death Talk with all lots of scumbags who are going to exterminate your family. They believe in the darkness and they want to bring it here to Earth because they're psychotic and they got their brains eaten away by fluoride.
You listen to the Vinnie Eastwood Show.
Vinnie, you have a hidden talent.
I'm 6'4". I can't hide from anything. My very special guest is Troy McLaughlin. And as I normally try to do, if I can remember during the last segments of each show, often there's things that we don't say that are the most important. You know, we all self-censor a little bit, and sometimes we wish we'd said something in a conversation, but we just didn't have the opportunity to, that kind of thing. And I sort of asked Troy to, you know, just think about those sorts of things or whatever. Just put them on the back burner and let's talk about them in the final segment. So, Troy, have you come up with anything?
Well, I think we actually started to slide into it at the end there, this importance of what the Golden Age means to the occult today, as we know, and how it links into this idea of Saturn worship that permeates, you know, the various occult belief systems, and even the belief systems of a lot of people that you wouldn't actually class as a cult, as in the scary movie type idea of the occult. But nonetheless, they feel free to stamp Saturnian images all over our money, all over our national symbols and things like that. Basically, going back to this idea that Earth originated under a sub-brown dwarf star, this, of course, I have to reiterate, is probably the hardest thing for most people to get a handle on. The Earth had been under this in the system, I believe, for millions of years, billions of years. It drifted while in this situation into contact with the sun. And the planets involved with that are all the planets in our solar system that share the same rotational axis that Earth has, roughly. You can pick them off. Venus, Mars, Earth, and Saturn. We've all got the same one. We're very different to the other rotational tilts that the other planets have. But basically, this arrival into this solar system, which caused the cataclysm that became known as the beginnings of the Golden Age, it came to an end in what became known as Doomsday. And I think this is crucial for most people to understand. The Golden Age represents two things. For some people, it represents a wonderful time or lack of want. You don't have to do any work. Nothing affects you. Nothing bothers you. You sleep when you want. You get up when you want. That sort of an idea. The other idea of a golden age is that it represents mankind's first foray into weights and measures and the ability to create law as a way of governing our interpersonal relationships, our interactions towards each other. When this all gets catastrophically destroyed in an actual physical doomsday event, i.e. Saturn is knocked from its position, the planets Venus and Mars go on a cosmic rampage, causing all kinds of electrical imbalances within the solar system, affecting Earth. And eventually the Earth settles down to a certain degree, with Saturn now banished to the outer parts of the realm, the solar system, and the Sun is now the main body in the sky. What we find is that it seems as simple as this, and a lot of people find this almost too simple. But what you have is you have a group of people who yearn for the golden age, as in, man, I wouldn't have had to do any work back in those days. I wouldn't have had to worry about where my next resources are coming from. I wouldn't have to worry about, whether I have to work or anything. It's summed up by the biblical term, by the sweat of your brow will you make the earth yield its fruits, which is the consequence of losing this paradise that the earth fell from. And as a result of that, you've got this group of people who hit upon the idea that they can get a golden age type existence by simply manipulating everybody else to do the work for them. I think this is actually at the basic fundamental human understanding of why there are people out there who want to control us, want to control the masses of humanity. This is their idea of having a golden age now in our time as it is at the moment. And of course they look forward to the crowning achievement would be possibly technologically induced immortality, whereby through their various eugenics programs and other scientific endeavors, a small group of in-the-know people get the chance to live out enhanced lives, an immortal life where the world is transformed into a new paradise, totally at their beck and call. And the humans that are left over are simply there as a slave pool so they essentially don't have to get the earth to yield its fruits by the sweat of their brow.
You're talking about it as in something that's they want to happen. I was thinking, hold on a second, it's already happening.
Absolutely. This is the thing, is that there's a reason why guys like Jung, the psychologists, are such great thinkers in their time. We give names to certain periods in history that belie where people's thoughts are. There's a time in history that was called the Gilded Age. It refers to that time when the Vanderbilts and the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds were starting to make their presence felt in the world. We're talking around about the 1820s through to about the 1920s, Carnegie, these kinds of people. These people had wealth that would make, honestly, Warren Buffett and Bill Gates were pocket change compared to the sums of money these people, the purchasing power that these people had at their disposal. Give an indication, John D. Rockefeller, I think, was at $460 billion in today's money as a personal bank account. Gates and Buffett don't even come close to that. And, we call that the Gilded Age, Golden Gilded Age. And it just belies this idea that there is a small elite that through the alchemy of financial manipulation, the interest usury system that they have, they perpetually try to create this golden age for themselves on Earth as it is. But at the same time, they do have a belief of a planet and its people reborn into a specific golden age in the future.
So essentially, we're talking about them creating...
I think they just want to be in on it.
Well, I think it's more like they want to bring back the Gilded Age for themselves and create a gilded cage mm-hmm. for the rest of us.
Yeah, I Couldn't agree more. That is essentially it. And on top of that, they have ideas. The frightening thing for the rest of us, of course, is they have a numerical number that they think is enough to service their needs. And we are something like, I think, 6.5 billion people over that number. You know, they only want 500 million people to service their needs. So, you know, if they can line up all their ducks, get their technology correct, if they can get their rituals that I believe some of them do believe in correct, and they can push us into the ultimate ritualistic climax of that triggers this new golden age, where they literally don't simply rule as very rich people in control. They rule as gods. They have a form of immortality. I think this is, you know, this is what underlies the psychology of a lot of these people. I've always been amazed that, yeah, sorry, go for it.
Well, I mean, and for those listening who think this sounds insane, you're precisely correct. They are.
Yeah, I've always been amazed at, you know, when I worked in the media, I interviewed some incredibly rich people. In fact, I've interviewed the richest man in China in my time. Not me doing the interview, but as part of the crew has gone through. So I've been in the presence of these people, and I've often wondered, man, after your first million, let alone your first billion, why don't you just kick back and enjoy life? You know, what drives this desire to you know, to keep going? And of course, there is this idea that it's about power. It's the ability to influence and have a basic psychological need they have. But something else also struck me as very odd with these people. They always seem to, at the ends of their lives, become obsessed with leaving a legacy. And that legacy is always, almost inevitably, expressed in terms of patronage of the arts. In other words, these are people who are not creative, but they understand that the creative element in humanity and so on is really the important part of what makes us human, this wonderful ability. And they, just in the same way as they try to buy influence, they try to buy in to this, the creative energies by, you know, finding artists and patronizing them and building museums and putting their names on it and so on like that. It's almost uniform with the super rich. This is how they seem to express themselves. And I think that gives us hope, because I think it shows them quite literally as very uncreative and very scared people near the ends of their lives, where they have this basic insecurity.
Yep. And I think that's really going to be their downfall, is that they've got these old plans that have been long laid out, and they're too uncreative to come up with new plans based upon, you know, their pre-existing ideals. And as Sun Tzu said, in the art of war, no battle plan has ever survived a battle. And I have great doubts that the elite will survive their own battle plans that they have drawn against the masses of humanity. The creative, the caring, and the good people in humanity will be the ones to rise up and defeat them, because they do not possess that which makes a human truly human. And thank you very much, Troy, for spending so much time with me today. Always a pleasure. I'm definitely going to have you on again sometime.
The pleasure's all mine, Vinny. Fantastic.